Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Lesmire. I'm here on behalf of State Farm Insurance Company. And I think the director has explained the issue to the committee about the controversy that has arisen in the state over the last 7 or 8 years. I think it's, I would describe it as a little differently. But there is a controversy about when your underinsured motorist coverage is triggered. We had one federal judge rule one way, another federal judge rule another way. The policy decision that Senator Donnelly has made is reflected in Amendment Number 1. And if it's the legislature's policy decision to make this pure excess and change the point to when it is triggered, which I believe is his intent, then Amendment Number 1 does that and does it in a way that is far cleaner and far better than the amendment that was proposed on the Senate floor. It's a very complicated issue, and I'd be happy to explain it further, but you may not need me to. So.
Okay. Representative Martin?
Well, Mr. Chairman, then with that approval, I'd like to move Amendment Number 1 for Senator Donnelly.
Amendment Number 1 has been moved. Is there any objection? Hearing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. Are there any further questions? Representative Davies.
Yeah, there was some reference in the director comments to whether or not a person had access to the I guess it was a repair company when insurance. Could you go back over that?
Through the chair.
One of the previous amendments that was.
Amendment that addressed the hierarchy on rental coverage, and that was proposed earlier on and is in the version that is before you. It clarified what has been the division's position on this throughout, was that if you go in to rent a vehicle and you decline the coverage they offer you, then the first, and you're in an accident, the first policy that they go against is yours because you made a decision to decline their coverage. If you have no coverage at all, then it can go against the renter's policy. The key here is if you decline the insurance, then you're assuming the liability and it should go against your policy. If you have no coverage, and decline the insurance, then clearly it is going to go against the insurance policy of the rentor.
No, I'm sorry. I haven't heard this bill described very clearly in a lot. I mean, we haven't had a lot of testimony on it, obviously. But one of the issues, that wasn't the issue, though. The issue, I think, had to do more with whether making the decision to total a car. Was there an amendment that addressed that?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, there is nothing in this bill that addresses that at all. Okay. There is no provision at all in here.
The Alaska statutes, as they stand right now, and not affected by this, then obviously allow the insurance companies to make that choice.
That is not addressed. That's correct. It's not addressed in here at all.
I mean, the stat. What about the existing statutes?
If the insurance company can make the decision on when it's totaled,
right.
Existing statutes does permit that.
Are there any further questions? The sponsor or of the director or Mr. Lesmire?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had one more concern, and I just want to mention it briefly, and I think this is a simple one. It involves the maintenance of records provision, and I think I wrote to the committee on this, and it's something that we are gravely concerned about. It requires a maintenance of records for 10 years, Section 9 on page 5, line 31. That is substantially longer than any other state in the country. The NAIC model language is 2 years. The longest time for maintenance of records of any other state is 6 years. And we understand that the director would not object to changing that 10 years to 5 years. And one of the concerns that we have is just we are concerned about the decrease in number of insurers that are doing business in this state. And we don't want to make this the worst state in the country to do business. And that's a change that we believe is non-controversial.
Commissioner, Director Burke.
Mr. Chairman, just one correction there. All domestic insurers in the state of Alaska are required to keep their records 10 years. That is already in regulations. I do not have, and the division has no objection, to changing it to 5 years.
Nor the sponsor, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Barton?
Mr. Chairman, would it not be better for the commissioner's office, instead of keeping a voluminous amount of records, would this help you, or give you a little more room? We change our license every 5 years, and so it would be almost a natural part of the questioning, do we have insurance?
I believe Representative Markin, it would actually be the insurance provider.
It's the carrier.
Keeping for the two carriers.
Right. Okay, so but you don't have to. Yeah. Would it save you a little money? And
that's our concern.
Would you pass that off to the customer, sir?
We would try to,
well, Mr. Chairman, if it's permissible, I'd like to make that an amendment that on page 5, line 31, that we delete 10 and insert 5.
There is amendment number 2. Do you understand, Bashar? Is there any objection to removing 10 and replacing it with 5? If not, the amendment is adopted. Are there any other concerns or any other questions to come before the committee? Duff, what is the will of the committee?
Here I would move committee substitute for Senate Bill, House Committee substitute for Committee substitute Senate Bill 104, Finance, House Finance amendment out of committee with individual recommendations.
And positive fiscal note.
I thought there was a small one. Oh, yeah, positive, we're making money.
That's right.
Good.
Actually, $500,000 next year. Are there any, there's a motion, are there any objections? Hearing none, bill will report out of committee. Thank you very much.
Very much.
Thank you. More like that.
Yeah. Those 50-page bills.
Bring up another abortion bill. Need your vote next week, Alvin?
Oh, I'll be there.
They made some good suggestions, some good changes. Pete's done it now.
I was there today.
Mm-hmm. We have
all right, and the last item before us today is Senate Bill 141. A small non-controversial little bill. I see members of the sponsor.
Changes.
Yeah, housekeeping measure. Babcock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tuckerman Babcock, special assistant to Senator Lyda Green, and your comments were very accurate about this bill. The intent of SB 141 is simple. There's no reason the permitted few should be more restricted than the unregulated many. All Alaskans who are not otherwise prohibited by federal or state law from owning or possessing handguns can carry handguns openly in certain places and can carry concealed without a permit in certain places. And Senator Green's suggestion in Senate Bill 141 is that an Alaskan ought to be able to carry a concealed handgun in those same places that Alaskans can currently carry them openly, especially because the people with a permit have been fingerprinted, background checked, and trained. That's the primary focus of Senate Bill 141. Now, there are some additions to this bill that accommodate retired peace officers and municipal police and lower the fees for the citizens of Alaska to apply for a permit and streamline the process for renewal and also recognize the permits from other states, but only if they have standards as strict as Alaska's. This bill is the work of some careful compromise, and it is the first firearms legislation to go through this body dealing with concealed carry that has the endorsement of the Alaska Peace Officers Association, and they object now only to the lowering of fees in this bill. Otherwise, the Alaska Peace Officers Association supports Senate Bill 141 as written. All the concerns of the Department of Public Safety have been addressed in the current version of Senate Bill 141. The police chiefs of the North Slope Borough and Valdez have testified in favor of Senate Bill 141. The Department of Public Safety does note that without an increase in volume, they fear reducing fees could result in not collecting enough revenue. There have been over 6,300 permits issued in Alaska for carrying concealed handguns since that right was recognized, and the Department of Public Safety has done a remarkable job of ensuring fair and speedy processing of these applications. But according to the information we have from the Department of Public Safety, Of the 6,300 permittees, not one person has used their concealed handgun to commit a crime. This bill does not change other state law restricting carrying weapons in bars or in schools, and it continues to allow private business and public buildings to use the criminal trespass statutes to forbid concealed carry with permits, just as they can today with open carry. And the penalty, whether this law is changed or not, is the same. The Alaska court system today bars firearms in court buildings. Passing SB 141 will not change their ability to do that. They will continue to be able to ban open or concealed carry in the courthouses. SB 141 does make it a little tougher for repeat misdemeanants to get apply for or keep a concealed carry permit. And it takes care of the discrepancy that those who are background checked, fingerprinted, and trained are more restricted than the 300,000 plus adults who could carry a gun openly. Under current law, as an example of the lack of common sense under the existing structure, if I had a concealed carry permit and were carrying my handgun concealed and went up to a bank, I could not go in. But if I took it out and carried it into my hand, I would be perfectly legal. In either case, with the passage of this legislation, banks would be able to make the choice of whether or not to put up a no trespass if you're carrying concealed, no trespass if you're carrying open. I have a lot more information and would be happy to answer any questions about each of the sections of the bill. You've all have sectionals distributed. But this bill is focused on revising Alaska's permit law, not on further gun control, not on changing the laws regarding open carry. And Senator Green would respectfully appreciate your consideration of this legislation.
Representative Davies.
Thank you. Just a question on the overall, and I guess a comment along with it, on the overall philosophy here. I don't disagree with the notion that people who get concealed handgun permits are generally very responsible. I think that, you know, I'm not arguing that, but so I don't want my comments to be taken in that context, but I do think that there is I don't think that it's necessarily a patently absurd situation to prohibit concealed carry in places where open carry is permitted. And I'll give you an example of that. Take a bank, for example, the example that you cited. It seems to me that we might want to prohibit concealed weapons in a bank and allow open carry, because carrying a weapon openly gives the security guard some additional information about what's going on. So I guess I would just offer that observation and ask for your comment on that. To me, it's not necessarily obvious that this is an absurd situation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davies, I have two comments to that. One is that the people who apply for permits to carry concealed, as evidenced over our experience in Alaska, are not those who commit crimes with those weapons. You're intent on causing mayhem in a bank, you're not going to be concerned about whether or not you have a permit. The other note that I would make is that in Michigan, for example, one of the only reasons you can get a concealed carry permit is to carry concealed into a bank. So I don't know that prohibiting permitted people in a bank would add any greater security to the comfort level in the bank. The people who want to rob the bank or cause trouble are still going to carry concealed if that's their intent, but there's no reason that the permitted people ought to be restricted in such a way.
Chairman. Representative Kelly and then Representative Florey.
Just to kind of add to what Mr. Babcock was saying there, I think too, in a bank, one of the reasons they have concealed carries as a confidential document. One of the reasons they have concealed carry, as I'm sure you're aware, confidential document, is that the people who carry them, we don't want to make targets in a crime situation. If someone knows, for instance, if people knew that a legislator or something like that had a concealed carry, they walked into a bank to rob a bank, the first thing they might do is kill the person that they know had a concealed carry. You're a public person, and if you had a concealed carry, you'd be an automatic target. I guess, too, in a bank situation, the person walking in with the gun then not only becomes more information to the security guard, but he also becomes more information to someone who might want to rob the bank, and that's the first person to get shot, whereas otherwise there might not be any mayhem whatsoever. So I can still follow his logic on that. But I had to have a question. That was, under this bill, and I think I asked you this before, and it's just escaped my mind, under this bill, can you carry concealed into a bar?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, no, you may not.
Okay, is that it, Representative Kelly, and then Representative Corey, and then Representative Davis?
Just to make a brief observation that I myself personally would feel safer having a concealed carry permit. That would permit me to take a weapon inside of a bank, frankly. If I was making a major deposit or going in to withdraw some gold bars out of my safety deposit box, I'd feel a whole lot better if I had some protection on me in the unlikely event that I would be apprehended.
You have gold bars in your safety?
Now I'll be a target. Where's my concealed carry permit?
I think your per diem's in far greater jeopardy than your permit.
Mr. Chairman, I also might note that another example, aside from the confrontational one that we've discussed here, regarding whether the gun agitates or calms the situation, is that many women who carry concealed don't like the feeling of swaggering around with a gun on their hip, going into a bank or carrying it in their hand, and it's some consideration to allow people to carry concealed if they've been background checked and fingerprinted and trained.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the explanation that we have so many thousand concealed permits now and there haven't been any problems are a testament that those persons who go through that process are upstanding citizens. That's probably somewhat of an argument that you can fall back on, but I'm not so sure how strong of an argument it is, being the short period of time that we have had concealed in the state. There really hasn't been a lot of time to analyze the value of that. I just wanted to point that out. It does cause me a bit of concern.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kelly?
I would just say that there is evidence from other states, however, in other states that have had concealed carry for a little longer period than we have, have had, I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that there hasn't been problems with people committing crimes who are concealed carry permittees in other states.
Mr. Chairman,
Davis.
The included in a packet that was distributed to the members of the committee, there's a Tennessee Law Review which does an analysis of many of the states, and one of the oldest laws in existence is Florida's, and what they have found with 10 years experience and hundreds of thousands of permits is that about one in every 10,000 permittees will have their permit revoked for misuse of a weapon. So we're still a long way from that measure in Alaska.
Yes, Representative Keller.
Just also like to add that misuse of a weapon can be a pretty broad which could mean that there isn't even a lot going on in those one in 10,000. By just showing a weapon in a potentially life-threatening situation, if you show a weapon, and you do not shoot that person because you did not have reason to shoot that person, then it is defined. That was not a life-threatening situation, and that is assault, that you merely showed it, and you can have your concealed carry permit removed for that. So even that 1 in 10,000 could be narrowed down even further.
Mr. Babcock, you addressed the question of fees and that you're looking to reduce the fees. What's the current fee structure, and what are you proposing to reduce it to?
Mr. Chairman, the current fee structure is up to $125 for your initial permit and $60 for renewal after 5 years. And Senator Green is proposing reducing that to $99 for your initial permit and $30 for renewal. And the course itself can be anywhere from $100 to $140 or $50. So for a couple to apply for and pay, go through the course and apply for the permit can be a hefty $400 or $500. And the Department of Public Safety, if the volume were to increase, they would be able to meet their target with the amount of money that $99 would bring in. The volume doesn't increase in the number of applications, they would fall short from what they would anticipate at one. They actually charge now $122.
And your language would allow them to charge up to $99?
Correct. The fixed cost for the department is roughly $60 with the FBI background check.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Babcock? Not. The first person signed up to testify is Laura
Hogan.
I'm sorry, Laura, I couldn't decipher your last name there with the handwriting.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Laurie Huguenin.
I apologize.
That's okay. The executive director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I'll keep my comments, I hope, fairly brief. We're concerned with three sections of the bill. Section 10, which talks about qualifications to obtain a permit. Section 13, which repeals and reenacts when a permit may be suspended. And Section 16, which repeals and reenacts where concealed weapons are permitted to be carried. For the qualifications to obtain a permit, I believe one of the reasons why there have not been problems with the people who are currently permitted is because in the list of current qualifications, you have excluded people who have committed felonies, people who have committed a various list of misdemeanors, including crimes against a person, and including last year with the passage of the Domestic Violence Prevention and Victim Services Act, a crime involving domestic violence. If the bill passes as it is, it removes that restriction from the list of qualifications, and we have strong concerns with that. People who are convicted of a crime involving domestic violence are not law-abiding and shouldn't be allowed to have a permit. Section 13, also in the current law, the 1865-735A, talks about when a permit may be suspended, and it's when there's been a charge of a crime against a person or a crime involving domestic violence or someone as a respondent in a protective order. Once again, a person has been placed themselves in a serious enough position where they've been charged with crime, even though they haven't been convicted. But we believe that it is appropriate to suspend a permit in that circumstance. It also has provisions for reinstating that permit once the charge has been dismissed or if the person has been adjudicated not guilty. So we believe the current statute should stand. And Section 16 that repeals and reenacts the list of prohibited places, I understand the argument that you want to be able to carry concealed where you can be able to carry openly. A facility that provides services to domestic violence and sexual assault, even though it's not listed in the crime section of misconduct involving a weapon, so you would be charged with a crime of carrying openly if you carried into a place, we're a locked facility. If someone comes to our door with a gun that's strapped onto their person, we can see that gun and we can deny permittance. If they carry concealed, we don't have necessarily that option to know that that gun is going to be coming onto our premises. I was concerned with the debate in the Senate, particularly when it was on the Senate floor, in characterizing people who provide services to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and the victims themselves as either being afraid of guns or sort of like being sitting ducks waiting for someone to come and blow us away with guns because they know that we don't have weapons. And I'd like to refute both those characterizations. I don't think we're afraid of guns, and I don't think we believe we're there sitting as sitting ducks and hiding behind our locked doors in fear. I think that choosing to exert our belief in creating peace through nonviolence doesn't mean that we're weak or defenseless. It means we're choosing a different way to respond to violence than by picking up a weapon and choosing to be violent ourselves. I think we're places of refuge and a sanctuary. I think we're places where people learn skills of dialogue and negotiation, of sharing and truth-telling. I think that we actively pursue peacemaking through developing principles of mutuality and trust and respect. I think we're working to protect ourselves, not through choosing to have a concealed weapon or having them on our premises or being able to shoot back if somebody shoots at us first. But we're protecting ourselves by trying to fundamentally change the way in which individuals act with each other. I think that we serve as microcosms of what we want the society to become. And I think we work toward creating peace by calling people away from that mentality that says might is right, or from the notion that there's a finite amount of power that can only be realized if somebody has less and somebody has more. that we're calling people away from instilling fear as an acceptable way to achieve what they want and from protecting themselves at the expense of others. I think we're calling people to the belief that power is infinite and it's within each person, that exerting who you are isn't a threat to who I am. I think we're calling people to a different journey. I think because we work to carry out our vision, it doesn't mean that we ignore the real world. I think we do see the ugliness that's there. We are not naive. People do use weapons. Some people will choose to defend themselves by using weapons back. We choose not to. We see daily the bruises, the broken bones, the fractured bones. We see death. I think we choose to arm ourselves with knowledge and with companions, with belief in the possible, and with our willingness to stand for peace. So while I appreciate the dialogue and the necessity some people see in wanting to arm themselves for protection, I think we should be respected for the stand we want to take by not having weapons on our premises. I think that needs to be clearly stated in the law so that no one's confused, no one has to look, well, is this a federal law or a state law? But when the department hands them their list of rules and regulations, they can see that where we are, guns aren't. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Laura?
I guess, Laura, in summary, you're saying that you would prefer some of the existing law to what is being proposed?
That's correct.
And explicitly as it pertains to sections 9?
I believe it's, I'm looking at the, I may not have the correct section of the bill. I'm looking at the Senate bill that was in rules.
Right.
Okay, section 10.
Okay, section 10.
Which is the list of qualifications.
Right.
Section 13. Which is in current law when permits may be suspended and when they may be reinstated. And it specifically talks about a crime involving domestic violence or being respondent in a protective order. And section 16, which is the list of prohibited places.
I guess I'm curious, as I read section 13, and I don't know what current law is here, so forgive me, but obviously you do here. It's proposing to say the department shall immediately suspend a permit to carry a concealed handgun if a permittee becomes ineligible to hold a permit under AS 1865-705. I would imagine that pertains to domestic assault or...
It's my understanding that that refers back to the list of qualifications, and under the list of qualifications in the bill, it would be if you've not been convicted of two or more Class A misdemeanors, if you've demonstrated a competence with the handguns, or if you're eligible to own or possess a handgun under the laws of the state. So it's my understanding that the bill has taken out being convicted of a crime involving domestic violence or being a respondent in a protective order. So I think those are current qualifications that wouldn't be if this bill passes.
Repealing that and reenacting
right,
it.
Right. Mr. Babcock, did you want to respond to that? I think there was some misunderstanding, at least on my part.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just note legal counsel's memo dated March 24, 1997, that it shall be unlawful for any person to possess a firearm who is subject to a court order that was issued after a hearing of which such person received actual notice and at which such person had an opportunity to participate, that restrains a person from harassing, stalking, or threatening an intimate partner or such person or child or such intimate partner or person or engaging in other conduct that would place an intimate partner in reasonable fear of bodily injury to the partner or child. That remains in federal law as a flat prohibition on possession. Includes a finding that such a person represents a credible threat to the physical safety of such intimate partner or child and by its terms explicitly prohibits the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against such a partner or child, or who's been convicted in any court of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
So it's your position then, Tuckerman, then that federal law already prohibits individuals who are under those circumstances from having a concealed carry permit?
From possessing any firearm.
From possessing any firearm.
I would say that there are some federal provisions. They are not as expansive as the Domestic Violence Protection Act that was passed last year. The protective order that is in our current statute, Alaska statute, includes emergency protective orders and ex parte protective orders. The federal law would not cover those. The federal law defines who is eligible to obtain a protective order in a much narrower field of persons than the list of people who are eligible to receive protective orders in the state of Alaska. So while it's correct, the federal provision would cover some people, they would not cover all the people who are eligible under Alaska law.
Could you give me an example, Laura?
If I can look in my book, I can, because I don't want to say the wrong thing, because I have the federal law with me as well. In the federal law, an intimate partner means the spouse of a person or the former spouse, someone who's a parent of a child of the person, or an individual who lives with or has lived with the person. Our state law includes current and former spouses, people who are living together or have lived together, people who are dating or who have dated. And that's not something that was just added last year. That was added several years ago in the expansion of who could get protective orders in the state of Alaska. So those people would not be covered under the federal exclusion. The state law also includes adults or minors who are engaged in sexual relationships, adults or minors who are related up to the fourth degree of consanguinity. It's my understanding that that covers nieces, nephews, aunts, and uncles in the list. People who are formerly related or related by marriage. People who have a child of the relationship, and that falls under the federal statute. Or a minor child of the person in the situations that I listed above. So there are some categories that apply in our state that would not fall under the federal provision. I would say the ones where it would happen most often, with the people we would most be excluding, would be those who are dating or who have dated.
Okay, so could you then give me a hypothetical situation from that scenario of using those who have dated and how it pertains to the concealed, the permit, or the inability to have a gun, or the ability to have a gun?
If I was in a dating relationship and I needed to go and get a protective order, I may need to get a 20-day order, which would give me enough time to make a safety plan and to do the things I needed to do to try to best get myself safe. I may not need a regular order, which is for 6 months. So I would go and get that. And if I was granted that order, and it was served on the person who had perpetrated the crime against me, that person would still be able to have their permitted concealed weapon. It would not be confiscated, and the permit would not be suspended. Did I answer your question?
No, you did. You did, and I'm trying to think. I guess I could see, I mean, there's almost, you've answered all part of the question in the opposite direction. The immediacy. If you can wait 20 days for the actual effect to take, or for the actual...
It starts immediately and lasts for 20 days.
And it lasts for 20 days. But the actual prohibition or the restriction of the handgun would not then take effect until 20 days, or would that only last for the 20-day window?
It's my understanding of the current statute that it would be immediately suspended and would last for the life of the protective order, so it would last for the 20 days, and it would expire. They would be able to get their permit back after the 20 days, unless some other remedy. I mean, you know, if no other thing happens.
What's the typical course of action if you get a 20-day? You have to excuse me. I don't come across these every day. What's the typical occurrence when you ask for a 20-day prohibition? What's the eventual or normal outcome of those events in terms of, you know, the domestic victim?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me.
Well, I'm trying to figure out where it goes. If after 20 days, do you go for another 20 days, or do you...
I see what you're saying.
What happens normally after that time period?
I think it varies. I think some people within that 20-day period in developing their safety plan decide that 20 days is not enough and they will need a longer order, and they would go for the regular 6-month order. I think some people make decisions to either leave the state or leave the community they're in, and they feel safe after the 20 days, and they don't try to get another order or renew that order. I think some people go back to their perpetrators for lots of different reasons, and they try again, and so they don't get another order. I think sometimes within those 20 days, they're modified. The protective orders could be modified, so they may not last the whole 20 days. So I think there's a variety of circumstances that happen. I would also like to say that that circumstance covers the protective orders, and that's a civil remedy. That doesn't cover the criminal remedy, which I believe also Mr. Babcock mentioned in saying that if you were convicted of a misdemeanor domestic violence, then you would also be prohibited from possessing a weapon, and that would be the criminal remedy. And just like for the civil remedy, Alaska's statutes are broader. The same is true in the criminal arena for the federal and the state statutes. The federal statute has the narrow definition of the person who can be convicted of domestic violence, and it has some restrictions about how the conviction takes place. The person has to be, they have to, I'm sorry, I've lost my place on the page.
No problem.
They will not be considered to have been convicted of the offense of a crime involving domestic violence unless they were represented by counsel, or they knowingly and intelligently waived their right to counsel. In the prosecution of the offense, the person had to be entitled to a jury trial, and either did have the jury trial, or the defendant had to knowingly and intelligently waive the right to the case and enter a guilty plea. They also would not be considered convicted of the offense if the offense was set aside, or if the person was pardoned. And I believe those are the circumstances. So I think that's also narrower than what would apply. Explain that very well.
Mr. Babcock?
Just, I did mention the broad federal preclusion of possession of firearms, except apparently for former dating partners. But I would point out that AS 1161-200A8 prohibits the possession of a firearm while a person is committing trespass in the first or second degree in violation of a domestic violence restraining order. NAS 1161-200A9 prohibits the possession of any firearm, concealed or open, while the possessor is communicating with another person in violation of their domestic violence restraining order. So I think that the cases are pretty well covered, and that someone who wished to do violence is not going to be concerned about whether or not they have a concealed carry permit in the first place, but that additional criminal penalties do accrue to anyone who does violate the domestic violence restraining orders and is possessing a weapon while they do it.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions for Laura? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next person to testify is Jana Green.
All night. You're going to continue it tomorrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jane Andreen. I'm Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and I'm here to express some concern that the Council has about Senate Bill 141. The legislature and the administration worked very hard 3 years ago to craft a concealed handgun permit system that had adequate safeguards. As has been said today, we have had no problems with that system to date, and I think that's due in very large part to the fact that we have such carefully crafted safeguards and provisions. As Ms. Huguenin said, there are three specific areas that the Council is particularly concerned about. First of all, protection for domestic violence and sexual assault victims needs to be of a primary, it needs to be paramount for us here in Alaska. Under the qualifications for eligibility, we are concerned that the prohibition for those who are respondent on a protective order has been jeopardized in that it is going to have to now fall under what federal law says. And as Ms. Huguenin stated, federal definitions of domestic violence are much more limited than what we have here in Alaska. We, I think, have done an excellent job of looking at the full picture of what domestic violence is, how the cycle occurs, and we've incorporated that into our process. Second, we're concerned that under the eligibility list, at this point in time, the way the bill reads, someone has to have been convicted of Class A misdemeanors in order to be eligible for a concealed handgun permit. The truth is, this excludes the vast majority of domestic violence offenders. Most domestic violence cases that do reach the criminal justice system are less than a Class A misdemeanor. We would like to retain the current language that's in statute that says that crimes involving domestic violence, someone who has a conviction sometime in the past 5 years of a crime involving domestic violence would not be eligible for a concealed handgun permit. Finally, one of the issues that I think has gotten a lot of press coverage this year and that we continue to be very concerned about is the prohibition of concealed handguns in domestic violence and sexual assault facilities. I was very disturbed on Sunday when I read in the Juneau Empire the first paragraph that covered this bill that talked about how victims need to have access, need to have handguns in order to, while they're in a domestic violence or sexual assault facility, in order to respond to return fire to the perpetrator who's sitting out in the parking lot. Ms. Huguenin talked a lot about the philosophy and what we're trying to achieve. I'd like to talk to you about a few different other aspects of it. First of all, we need to acknowledge that some domestic violence and sexual assault victims are very proficient in handguns, know how to use them, have possibly even concealed handgun permits. That's not a problem. But the reality is many, many domestic violence and sexual assault victims do not have that level of proficiency, are not comfortable with them. Another reality that we have to factor in is there are a lot of other people and children that are in domestic violence and sexual assault facilities. I'm very concerned at the thought that we need to have those handguns within those facilities in order to protect. What we have done to date is ensured that domestic violence and sexual assault facilities by regulation have emergency procedures to deal with any number of emergencies that may come up, including earthquakes, fire, and intruders. What happens if there is a threat to the people within that facility? When we do an on-site evaluation, one of the things that we look at is what kind of security system do you have in place? What's the response time from local law enforcement? We think it's very important that we use the criminal justice system, use the public safety process and system to enforce the safety of victims. For those victims that have the proficiency, the access to, the ability to use handguns, that's fine. But let's acknowledge that the vast majority of victims do not have that. One of the things that I would like to ask this committee to consider is, as you're looking at this bill, is going beyond what the current statute says and is laid out here in Amendment Number 1 that I looked at that I know hasn't been introduced yet. Let's look at banning all handguns from domestic violence and sexual assault facilities, both openly carried and concealed. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Are there any questions for Jane? Thank you, Jane. The next person we have to testify is Arthur. Mr. Snowden.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Judicial Branch of Government. The Supreme Court feels strongly that we need an amendment to this bill that would ban all firearms in court facilities, not just concealed weapons, but all firearms. And the question is, well, we haven't banned them to date, and you can do it by court rule, have been the suggestions I've heard. We haven't banned them to date because in the past, we were the old concealed weapons bill did ban them from courthouses, number one. Number two, federal law does ban them from federal courthouses, but they don't deal with state courthouses, so I don't have a federal umbrella. The people of the state are not charged with knowing what court rules are. They are charged with knowing what the statutes of this state say. You all were around many years ago when courthouses didn't have to have security systems. Our courthouses now, regrettably, need security systems. We only have two in the state, Fairbanks and Anchorage. Generally, if we could saw somebody in the past come into the other courthouses with a rifle, we could see them and we could do something about it. Courthouses are highly charged environments. We're dealing with not just domestic violence, but divorce and many other areas, and you've all read in the paper about people getting killed in courthouses. These are otherwise honorable people who get really involved in the emotion of the action. This is a very emotionally charged area. We asked this committee earlier on to put security money in our budget. You're unable to do that, and I understand that. The budget is tight. But we are inviting a major problem in our courthouses unless we, by statute, which many states do, ban the carrying of firearms in our state courthouses. And the Supreme Court feels strongly about it. And we can put up a notice, and we can do it by rule, but people aren't charged with knowing that. And this is a very dangerous situation, and I want to make that as clear as I can. And I want to put it on the table that we are very much afraid of what could and would happen. And we think that we need a statute in this state that forbids the carrying of firearms into judicial facilities. I'm not trying to single out concealed weapons. I'm saying all firearms. It's easier to see a big gun, but the fact is, you know how dangerous the situation I'm talking about. You read in the paper every day about what's happening in courthouses. You also know that we only have security in two of our courthouses. This is something that's going to create a major problem. We feel very strongly, that this bill needs to be amended to ban the carrying of firearms in state courthouses. Now, I could go on, but you've been listening to a lot of testimony, and I'm not going to get into all the areas and take up a lot of your time. But I will tell you, for the record, that the Supreme Court does feel strongly about it, and we would very much like you to consider amending this legislation to do what most states do and do what the federal government does, and that's to forbid the carrying of firearms in a judicial facility.
Mr. Representative Corey, then Representative Davis.
Well, Art, you speak very eloquently, and I respect where you're coming from, I might add also. But you have made two comments here. You said we've all seen and heard of cases where there's been incidences in court facilities, and also that we read about it every day in the newspapers. Can you cite some examples of where that's happened in Alaska here? What historical data can you back up your statements with?
I can show you a bullet hole in the ceiling in the building across the street, but for the most fact, I cannot, through the chair, Representative Coring, because this is a new twist, as I say. In the old days, the last concealed weapons bill, it did ban them in courthouses. And when you deal with an open weapon, the public safety guards that we have, which are few, could stop that. But this is pretty new here. But I can tell you in most states, and in the federal law, it is in statute, and it is in federal law. And I think for most cases, Representative Coring, you never saw courthouses with security systems up to about 10 or 12 years ago either. But that is the way life is becoming. And I'm not picking on people with concealed weapons. They're fine and honorable people, just like people who carry rifles and everything else. But I'm talking about an emotionally charged situation that happens in courthouses, that happens almost nowhere else. And I would be glad to bring you a multitude of articles, if you would like me to, about shootings in court facilities.
Yes, if I may follow, Mr. Chairman, which is why I respectfully disagree with you as far as the need to restrict concealed carry in court facilities, is because these are not only fine and honorable people, but individuals that are law-abiding folks, and the prospects of anything happening, I would take the position that would be very minimal. Just given the process they go through in getting their concealed carry permit, from their background checks to the training they go through to the whole shooting match, we're talking about law-abiding people, and the prospect of anything happening is very minimal in my view. It's the same concept of concealed carry in a bank or on a school facility or whatever the case may be, you know.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, conceal weapon in a bank is a neutral thing. When people come into courthouses, it gets otherwise very nice people when they get involved in divorces and custody fights. That is where most people are killed in courthouses. I respectfully disagree. And they are fine and honorable people, but their emotions and their egos and their psyches get involved in this. And it has been shown across the country that most people get killed in courthouses, in domestic violence courthouse rooms, and in divorce courts. Sure, we can, you know, watch major felony cases and so on and so forth, where these are fringe elements and those kinds of people you may, you know, you could protect against. But I'm trying to protect in the ordinary course of business. When people get divorced, once in a while it's civilized, but often it's not. And I would respectfully disagree with you that otherwise honorable people could not and would not get emotionally involved in the in these areas.
Representative Martin and Representative Kelly.
Mr. Nunn, I'm looking at the difference between a statute and a court ruling. And I know often we have trouble, and sometimes it's good that we have trouble overruling or amending or adjusting a court ruling. And I thought that if the judiciary made a court ruling to this, it would be far superior to any statute because we wouldn't be able to change it without two-thirds, whereas a statute, simple 21. Would the courts consider or have they considered making a court ruling pertaining to this?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, the court has a rule against concealed weapons. Our citizens are not charged by law with knowing or basically even obeying court rules. We can hold them in contempt or we could throw them out of the building, but they are charged by law with knowing the statutes and laws with this state. And I think we've come to the time in our history, as so many other states have and as the federal government has, where we need to ban firearms by law so that people do know, because they are charged with knowing what the laws of this state are, that they cannot carry guns of any type in courthouses.
In consideration of the ruling, though, you don't feel like there is a court ruling today. What does the court do to make people realize on a regular basis more than go read the state statutes? It seemed like that the court had a better system or would have a better system warning citizens that it is against the judiciary court rulings to have weapons in their facilities.
Mr. Chairman, if the law helps. I'm sorry.
Yeah, if that doesn't help, the statute ain't going to help. As you say, these people are emotionally charged, and I agree with you. There's a traumatic thing that's happening in their life, and they have no other way to solve it. And I don't see where a statute would help you any more than a court rule, and I thought the court rule would even be stronger.
Mr. Chairman, the Supreme Court does not think it is. Until, in the present law, you cannot carry a concealed weapon into a court facility. If a guard sees a rifle, he can do something about it. That's part of the law now. What this change in the law would do would take that out of the law, basically, and then you would be charged by looking at our court rules. Nobody knows what our court rule says. I would imagine there's not a person in this room who could quote one of our court rules, but they are charged with knowing what statutes say. I think this is a very important area, especially due to the lack of security that we have in our Alaska court facilities today.
On one little question, you mentioned a bullet in the ceiling. Isn't that at the Anchor Times building? Had nothing to do with the court, didn't it?
I think there's one there too, Mr. Chairman, but I am talking about there's a bullet in the ceiling of the district court right across the street.
It's not the Ramsey belt case. Okay.
Juno.
All right.
Representative Kelly.
Got me with my mouth full. The question is, are we going to have any more testimony?
I believe Mr. Guinelli, did you want to testify? Or he's the last.
I'll hold my remarks till. Okay.
Are there more questions for Mr. Snowden? If not, the plan is to finish testimony today, and then we'll take up amendments at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Unfortunately, it falls on this committee to really make the kind of substantive, or consider the kind of substantive amendments that might have been considered in other committees, but this bill is moving quickly and we want to be responsive to the desire to move it quickly. I think that there are some remaining problems with this bill that the committee needs to address. The problems fall into two areas. Current law establishes a list of classes of people who cannot get concealed handgun permits. This bill sweeps away most of those protections. This current law also contains a long list of places where concealed handguns cannot be carried, and this bill sweeps away most of those. I'd like to focus on just a few of the provisions that are being repealed by the bill. And you've heard talk about the protections needed by victims of domestic violence, people who have been who have gotten court orders for injunctions for domestic violence restraining orders. And I won't say a lot about that. I would say, however, that Mr. Snowden's idea about banning all types of firearms in courthouses is really the kind of ultimate protection that domestic violence shelters and places that provide services to domestic violence victims really need. And I would suggest, if there's going to be an amendment dealing with the courthouses, that there be an additional line added in there to take into consideration those places where services are provided to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And it would be a small amendment. It's something that's provided in the current concealed handgun law, but I think it really makes sense to ban all types of weapons in those areas. If there really is any types of places that are really emotionally charged, like courtrooms, it would be domestic violence shelters, domestic violence places where counseling services are provided. So that's all I'm going to say on that topic. As far as the classes of people who cannot get concealed handguns now, there are a number of them that I think are important that remain in current law. For example, current law says that someone who is suffering from a mental illness, as defined in Alaska law, cannot get a concealed handgun permit. It's fine to say that we can rely on federal law to provide that same protection, but federal law says if you've been adjudicated a mental defective or you've been institutionalized, then you can't carry a firearm. But the trend in society now is to deinstitutionalize people, not to adjudicate people who are mentally ill, to try to treat them within the community, try to treat them with medication and things like that. And there are an awful lot of people, and I'm sure you all know some of them, who are walking the streets who are quite paranoid. They're otherwise law-abiding citizens. They don't violate the law, but they're crazy. And it scares me to think that those people could, under this bill, walk in and get a concealed handgun permit. The way it works now is Department of Public Safety, and it doesn't happen very often. Department of Public Safety will receive an application from someone who otherwise looks like a perfect applicant, but then they'll start receiving letters from the person's family or from the person's psychiatrist saying, we think you ought to know these things about this applicant. And then they'll take a closer look, and if they determine that the person is mentally ill, they'll deny the application. That kind of protection will not exist under federal law and needs to remain in current law. There are a couple of other provisions relating to people who have, within Alaska, been ordered by a court into alcohol rehabilitation within the last 3 years. I think that's another example of something that, particularly given the extent of alcohol abuse in Alaska, really makes a lot of sense. Those kind of people, if they've been to alcohol rehab ordered by a court within the last 3 years, they shouldn't be carrying a concealed handgun, and they shouldn't get a permit. Let's wait 3 years, see if the rehabilitation has taken, and then they can get their permit. Federal law doesn't speak to serious alcoholics like that at all. Federal law just talks about someone who's addicted or habitual user of a controlled substance. Doesn't talk about alcoholics. Current Alaska law also has provision if you've been in treatment, a drug rehab treatment within the last 3 years, you can't get a concealed handgun permit. If you read the federal definition of someone who's addicted, you really, you know, what it conjures up in your mind is someone who's out in the back alley shooting up or smoking crack all the time. But the fact of the matter is there are an awful lot of people who are going through drug rehab treatment right now or who have just completed drug rehab treatment, and we really ought to see if that takes before we allow them to have a concealed handgun permit. Those are provisions that really only are in Alaska law. They aren't covered by the federal law, and they're good provisions. I think they make an awful lot of sense, and I would ask that you consider those provisions. Those are the classes of people, you know, sort of the who can get a permit or who can't get a permit. Then there's a question of where can concealed handguns be carried. There's a long list of places where they can't be carried right now: police stations, correctional facilities, state office building, courthouses, domestic violence shelters. I think that many of those really are important provisions that ought to remain in the law. But I also see that there is a strong sentiment for loosening up the law considerably. I think that what's important is that if there is going to be any loosening up of law to expand the places where concealed handguns can be carried under permit, then there at least there needs to be a provision where the owner of a particular building or the manager of a particular building can post a notice saying, we don't want concealed handguns on our premises. And that would be covered under the criminal trespass laws. problem is that that works for a private building. A private building owner can post a sign. If a person violates that, they're guilty of a trespass. In public buildings and those open to the public, that would be, you know, police departments, correctional centers, office building, you can post all the signs you want and they have no legal effect. They can't bar someone from going on the premises. What has to happen in open public buildings is you have to confront the person, order them to leave, and they have to refuse to leave before it's considered a trespass. And I think that with the situation of guns, I think that's a dangerous situation. I think that, for example, correctional facilities ought to be able to post a sign at the entrance to the facility saying, no guns allowed. They shouldn't have to wait until somebody comes in the premises, goes into the visitor's waiting room, and then is confronted and challenged and told to leave. I think the correctional facilities, the police departments, those kind of public buildings ought to have the same authority as private building owners to post a sign and say, you know, stay away, this is a place you ought not to be with a gun. So I would, if there's going to be a great expansion of the places where concealed handguns are carried under permit, then there at least needs to be an amendment to the state criminal trespass laws to give public buildings and public premises the same rights as private premises. That's my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I'll certainly be here tomorrow morning to answer any questions about any amendments.
Are there any questions for Mr. Pennelly? Representative Davies.
Clarify for me the situation under the trespass laws right now. Does currently they allow is it any private property owner to post such a sign?
through the chair, Representative Davies. Current law says that if you have a place that's not open to the public or where someone is otherwise not privileged to be, that a sign is effective to prohibit trespassing or skateboarding or digging or other types of activities. It's the general criminal trespass law would allow signs of various types to be posted.
Including a ban against concealed weapons?
Including a ban against concealed weapons.
Does that include a shopping mall?
That would include shopping malls as well. Well, actually, that's a good question. The question is whether someplace that's open to the general commercial public is really a private premises or whether it's open to the public. And that's something that's not answered in current Alaska law or elsewhere. And that's something that I think ought to be corrected. I mean, I think there ought to be a uniform standard so that all places, shopping malls if they want, private office building, private apartment buildings, those kind of places could post a sign.
And does this bill affect the current law with respect to the issue of private property owners putting up a sign?
This bill does not. As it's written right now, it does not affect any of the criminal trespass laws. But I would note that I believe the title is certainly broad enough to include something that's so designed.
Thank you.
If everybody could stay for a moment. In deference to Representative Kelly, who leaves tomorrow morning at 6 in the morning, and he does have the First Amendment out of the chute, Pete's trying to get Terry so we can take some action. And I've called for Senator Green's office to come back up here. We could at least discuss potentially his amendment before he leaves in the morning. With the committee's indulgence.
Mr. Chair, we're indulging you.
With that, we'll go at ease for a couple moments.
What bill we're on?
141. All right. Right, Chair?
Yeah. Chairman.
Reconvene the meeting. It's 5:30. We're on amendment number one. For the benefit of Representative Grisdorf, who has joined us, we're on Senate Bill 141, amendment number one. And I offered some latitude to Representative Kelly to offer the amendment before tomorrow morning as he was going to be leaving early, and I wanted to give him the opportunity to make the motion. Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
Is there objection?
I would respectfully object.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, earlier in discussion, Representative Coring, as a matter of fact, was talking about the fact that the courtroom is analogous to the bank analogy. And I don't think so. I think a courtroom is an area where these people who have concealed carries, who will not commit crimes, who are not the people in society that we are worried about,
who I am very happy to arm them to the teeth wherever the heck they want to go, except into some areas where I think they can change from reasonable people into unreasonable people. A friend of mine, you probably know him and have heard the stories about him, was in a courtroom, and he had and his daughter had been arrested on a peaceful demonstration. His daughter was brought into the courtroom in chains. He went crazy. Had he been armed, he may have not been able to restrain himself. I also have been involved in a couple of custody cases where people are fighting over a child, or possibly in a DFYS case where someone is taking away your child. What are you supposed to do when somebody takes away your child? I have the answer. It's blow them away. So I think in those instances, the courtroom is a different instance. It is one of the areas that I, as someone who is as pro-gun as you can get, can say, yeah, we probably ought to make an exception here, and it's a reasonable exception that people who are pro-gun can buy into. I think we have a long-standing tradition. The philosophy of John Wayne, I've watched enough John Wayne movies that I'm kind of an expert on this. It's a tradition. You check your guns at the saloon and you check your guns at the courthouse. This is nothing new. Third, I think because it is a charged environment, we increase the chances that somebody who is a concealed carry permittee will lose it, and they will blow somebody away, and then all of our work to get concealed carry in this state is going to go away. And that's going to be the one case out of hundreds of thousands or millions of concealed carry all over the country. That's going to be the one case that becomes the cause celeb for all the anti-gunners out there who want to take concealed carry and ram it right back down our throats. And last year we had this bill before us, and I had the same feelings then, and I didn't offer the amendment. And for that reason, this year, I'm not going to let it go by. I think we owe it to ourselves to do this so that we can have concealed carry in this state from here on out.
Representative Foster?
Yeah, I would just leave some of my guns with ATF. I wanted to hear some of Tuckerman's thoughts on this. I know we touched on it briefly before. Maybe if you can expound on this.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Foster, I think, first of all, it would be good to correct some of Representative Coring's statements and some of Representative Kelly's statements. Currently under the law, and passing this bill would not affect this, carrying openly or concealed in a courthouse is forbidden. It is prohibited. You will be thrown in jail by the court system if you go into a courthouse with a gun, if they so choose, because you will be in contempt of court. There won't be a trial. It will be immediate. However, since that is the law, there's obviously no objection whatsoever to adding it as part of the statute. However, Representative Kelly, through the chair, it is entirely redundant. It is, in fact, already against the law to carry concealed or openly in Alaska's courthouses. And with that, there's absolutely no reason to object to something that already exists and is prohibited from being prohibited again.
Is the objection maintained, Representative Corey?
I think so. I'm just, I don't know. By having a statute in addition to what's already on the books, to me it's kind of going down the road of gun control, frankly, in my mind. And it might actually kind of be a precedent setting. It might actually start the ball rolling of placing restrictions elsewhere on our Second Amendment rights that the ability to be able to carry concealed guns. So, apparently, there's a reason I'd like to maintain that direction.
Representative Risendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reference by Representative Kelly to John Wayne convinced me that I'm willing to check my gun at the saloon door and also at the courthouse door. I think it was good enough for the Duke and the American tradition. I'm all for it. Sounds good to me.
Are there any further comments or questions? Not the objections maintained. Shar, could you call the roll?
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Coring?
No.
Representative Mulder?
Yes.
Representative Davies?
Yeah.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
6-1 passed.
The amendment has been adopted. What is the will of the committee? Do they want to go through some more amendments or take them up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning?
9 tomorrow morning.
Actually, I was corrected, unfortunately. We do have three other bills tomorrow morning, too.
All right, I got to get up tonight. Are
they ones that I'm interested in?
Let's ask Representative
Kelly. The ones I'm interested in?
There's 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 offered by Representative Davies.
8 o'clock? 8 o'clock?
To what bill? Mr. Chairman, he has a lot of amendments. It's probably not a good bill.
What's the will of the committee?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock?
Yeah.
8 o'clock. We will now recess until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you, everybody, for staying.